Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the Clinton administration is trying to trade bureaucratic hassle for environmental protection. Can it work, or are they giving the store away? We'll talk green about cockroaches and other bugs. They've been around longer than we have, and we can't live without them. A very tough winter in Yellowstone Park. Record numbers of bison are moving to lower rangelands and certain execution. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. Last week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency signed an agreement with the Weyerhaeuser Forest Products Company covering their Flint River pulp mill in Oglethorpe, Georgia. Water use will be reduced to less than half the industry average. Wastewater and chlorine discharges will be limited, and Weyerhaeuser agreed to management practices in its upstream forests that will enhance wildlife. In exchange, some regulations affecting Weyerhaeuser were relaxed. The agreement was the result of Project XL, which the EPA launched in 1995. John Kessler, director of the Emerging Strategies Division of EPA, describes how, under Project XL, EPA has negotiated comprehensive pollution control agreements with particular industries.
Each XL project is an agreement with an individual facility, with local citizens, with the state or local agencies, and with EPA. In which each agreement has really three key features. First of all, it provides a greater level of environmental protection, what we call superior environmental performance, relative to what would happen without Project XL. Secondly, it provides a greater level of accountability to local citizens and to government agencies, so we all have a greater ability to see what's going on. And third, it provides greater flexibility to the facility itself or group of facilities in terms of how it achieves those environmental goals. So it's basically superior environmental performance, greater accountability to citizens for that performance, and greater flexibility in how that performance is achieved.
A fundamental aspect of XL agreements is that citizen groups participate in the negotiations, and more data about the performance of the industry is released to the public while the agreement is in force. Also, the agreements cover things that are not part of the normal air and water permitting processes.
And this is a feature of many of these XL projects, that is that we're getting things, we're not only getting reduced loadings of the things we do regulate, very often these agreements incorporate things that we don't. In the case of Intel, one of the things that the local community was concerned about, in addition to the things we do regulate, was there were kind of two other things, one water use and the other setbacks for the plant. And basically, the centerpiece of our agreement was an air permit. And so we said, well, you know, how do you put those kind of things in an air permit? And we negotiated an agreement that includes quarter-mile setbacks for the plant, which is what the local community wanted, and that basically ensures that not only is the facility not a net user of local water, it actually takes the discharge from the local publicly owned treatment works and uses that water as its base product, and then returns that water to the community in a form that is purer than when it received it.
Kate Tate, who is the Environment Communications Manager for the Weyerhaeuser Company, says the incentive for the company to enter into the agreement was to get more leeway from EPA.
We were seeking flexibility in the area of environmental rules in several areas. First of all, in how we achieve pollution prevention, in our the various permitting for things such as developing new products and performing trials on those new products. We were seeking flexibility in reduced reporting and record keeping. And I think one other major thing is we were seeking predictability in terms of permit requirements over the life of the permit.
Not all of the XL initiatives have resulted in agreements. In Minnesota, the 3M company negotiated an XL agreement through the State of Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The deal fell through, though, when EPA wanted greater guarantees of continued improvement. 3M refused to be interviewed by the Environment Show, but Peter Larson, commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, says that when the XL agreement collapsed, 3M went back to the traditional permitting processes.
Most importantly for us was the our goal of really trying to experiment, really trust a company that at this site had provided incredible environmental performance, and really use that as an opportunity to try to figure out a new way of doing business. EPA didn't have quite the willingness to experiment that we thought was appropriate. The project got tied up into some knots that just couldn't be untied.
Environmentalist David Hawkins, senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, sees Project XL as an attractive idea, but says it needs clearer definition.
The way EPA should proceed is to identify some key environmental needs in the general area of improving innovation, maybe pollution prevention, other objectives. You know, what would the EPA like to see developed out there in the private sector in order to make progress environmentally, and then solicit a competition for proposals to address those needs, and then select the ones that are proposing to do the best job. And if those proposals identify some changes in existing rules and regulations that are needed in order to make the proposals a reality, then sit down and work out the differences and try to make it happen. But I think what we have currently in the current crop is the flip side. We have companies which have identified existing rules and regulations that they don't like for one reason or another. Some of the objections may be legitimate, but basically the process has been the company identifies an existing set of rules and regulations that it doesn't like, and it says, well, we really would like to get out from under these things. Let's see if we can come up with a package that we can wrap around our basic objective of getting out from under the rules and regulations that will be attractive enough to pass muster with EPA. And because EPA hasn't set up any real criteria, they're tempted, the companies are tempted to come in with as minimal a package as possible.
Regulatory reform is on everybody's agenda. Through Project XL, EPA is trying to find better ways to manage all of the environmental impacts of a facility, using the promise of relief from its own bureaucratic procedures as a bargaining chip. Is your neighborhood having a problem with deer? Are they eating your bushes and clogging your roads? Or are they too scarce for good hunting? We want to hear from you about deer or any other environmental issue. Join us on the air and talk green. Dial our toll-free number at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Can you hit that soldier? Hi, I'm your host, Peter Burley, and you're talking green on the Environment Show. And today we're talking about bugs. To some, they're creepy, crawly things. To biologists and entomologists, they're probably the things that make nature work, from pollinating plants to disposing of waste. We have two guests with us, David George Gordon, whose new book is called The Complete Cockroach. He's a nature writer, and he lives in Port Townsend, Washington, with a group of about 40 Madagascan hissing cockroaches. And Steve Perkle, who is founder and director of the Sonora Arthropod Studies Institute in Tucson, Arizona. David Gordon, let's start with you. Why
sure.
does someone live with pet Madagascan hissing cockroaches?
Well, you know, in the Northwest, where I live, cockroaches are kind of a novelty act. They're not the same as when I lived in Chicago or have visited New York, where they're everywhere. When I started working on my book, The Complete Cockroach, someone actually mailed me my cockroaches by Federal Express from Minnesota. And these guys are actually popular pets. I keep them in a nice 15-gallon aquarium with a tight-fitting top. There's a heater in there because they're tropical bugs. And they keep me company when I'm working late at night.
Okay. And what are cockroaches' role in the biological scheme of things.
Well, you know, the Madagascan hissing cockroaches are great reminders that not all cockroaches are pests. In fact, there's really only about, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and maybe 30 species of cockroaches worldwide that really plague people. Keep in mind that there are actually 3,500 different kinds of cockroaches worldwide.
And you have seen each one of them, I trust.
I've seen as many as I can. When they're not out there pestering us in our homes, they perform a lot of important functions. And you mentioned a few in your introduction. Some are plant pollinators. If they were to disappear, probably the plants would go too. Cockroaches are also food for a whole array of animals, everything from really small creatures like predatory wasps all the way up through snakes and frogs and toads and birds up to ocelots and even humans. And probably most important of all, cockroaches are recyclers of dead plant and animal material in the forest. I've seen studies that show that they can consume about 6% of the yearly leaf fall in one part of the Amazon River basin.
Wow.
Yeah, that's important.
Steve Perkle, are cockroaches part of your activities in the Arthropod Institute?
Yes, the Northern Arthropod Studies Institute is an environmental education organization focusing on the arthropods that occur within the Sonoran Desert, which is a very rich area within the country. And we've got roaches here, some that are introduced pests, the pests that you find in the city. But we've got a roach that occurs here on our grounds, lives out in the desert, and instead of making its home in human kitchens, it does it in rodent burrows. The females are flightless. The males have wings.
And what function, if we can say that, what role do they play in the ecosystem of the desert?
They're decomposers, feeding on rodent feces and bits of food that have been dropped in leaf litter. And since they are fossorial, digging down into the ground, they help loosen up topsoil so that plant roots breathe and seeds germinate easier and those kinds of things.
And let me ask you both something. We normally think of predators and prey. What eats the cockroach, if anything?
You know, in the desert, and I know this is not going to sell cockroaches to your listeners, but in the desert, they're also food for scorpions, for example.
Right.
But in other environments, you know, just about everybody eats cockroaches. They're abundant. They're rich in protein. They don't have an abhorrent taste, unlike ladybugs, for example. So they're a very popular prey item. There are cockroaches I discovered that look just like fireflies in Central America and actually live in birds' nests. But if they didn't do that, they'd be breakfast, lunch, and dinner for those birds.
And are there any human cultures that have seen the cockroach as an important part of their diet?
Yeah, I've read that the Hill Tribe people of northern Thailand eat cockroaches. There's some anecdotal information about African indigenous people as well. In my book, The Complete Cockroach, I go through a whole section about medicinal uses of cockroaches. In ancient Greece, for example, it was believed that cockroaches mashed up and mixed with rose oil could cure earaches.
Well, and, maybe that's the way to get rid of them in all those New York City apartments.
That's right. More recently, I read a memoir of Louis Armstrong where he talks about whenever he had a cold, his mother would make him cockroach tea.
Okay.
And maybe that's why Louis sings the way he does.
Let's go to the phones, and let's pick up a call from Long Island. Jen, you're Talking Green in the Environment Show.
Hi. I feel a little guilty asking this question because you're talking about all the positive aspects of the cockroach.
We're just trying to put you in a good frame of mind.
Yeah. I am going to be moving to New York City soon, and I was wondering if there's like an environmentally safe way of getting rid of them without like bug bombs or pesticides.
Oh, absolutely. You know, getting rid of them, though, may be the wrong word. I say controlling them, because you might never get rid of them. In my book, I go through a whole array of alternatives, starting out with really environmentally friendly ways, like, for example, keeping a hedgehog in your kitchen. That's something Victorian English people used to do. And I end up with...
Otherwise known as a woodchuck.
Yeah.
Is that an approved method in the city of New York? Do landlords feel okay about that?
Yeah, I think boric acid powder works quite well. Would you agree, Steve?
Yes, boric acid works well. And a building that we occupied when I first started SASE back in 86 was in an area kind of like New York in the older part of Tucson, and had a real bad problem with the American cockroach. And we couldn't spray because we were exhibiting insects, and didn't ethically want to be using the toxins, but we couldn't without killing off all of our displays. And we found the some of the roach motels, the sticky traps, and also some of the baits to be quite effective without being real harmful to the environment.
Yeah, boric acid is a pretty benign substance. You know, it's in eyewashes and contact lens solutions.
Right,
but
and
if cockroaches eat too much of it, it kicks them off.
Okay.
Okay,
Jim,
thanks
for your call. And let's pick up a call from Seattle, Washington. I guess I've got Cisco Morris. Welcome
Hi.
To the Environment Show.
Howdy. I'm calling in because I just wanted to say I'm the head gardener at Seattle University.
Uh-huh.
We're the biggest private university in Washington State, and we're the only university in Washington State designated as a wildlife sanctuary.
And how do you deal with your cockroach problem or pesticide problems generally?
Well, we do have cockroaches, but I don't want anybody to hear that. But
okay, but, this is just between us. There are
okay,
only half a million
us.
People
no
listening, but they won't
this.
Tell.
But, you know, there's all these incredible insects out there that eat other bugs, or they stick an egg in them, and the egg hatches, and it eats up the bad guys. So what we do is we make life real good for the good bugs. For instance, it doesn't really work to buy ladybugs and put them on your campus because they tend to fly away. But lady beetles come if you don't use many poisons, if you make sure there's lots of bad guys to eat. So what we do is we bring in trees that we know attract aphids that all gardeners hate. And then what happens is all these lady beetles come, and syrphid flies and lacewings, all these beneficial insects, they come, they gobble up the bad guys, and then they disperse all over the campus and keep eating the bad guys up. And we use no poisons at all now to maintain a garden that's described as one of the best in the United States.
Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's great.
Let me ask both David and Steve whether the next generation of human activity as it relates to gardening and bugs really will involve much better and more effective natural control so that this whole system works rather than being bombed with one chemical after another.
I think it will, and I think that it has to.
And how do we start? I mean, how does this come about when you've got the what appears to be the massive marketing campaigns of the chemical guys every spring? Buy
well,
the magic
thing
chemical that kills
that people
everything.
People get over their insect fears. That the people have an inordinate, in a lot of cases, inordinate fear of what they believe are harmful creatures. And, you know, the coexistence is really part of the ticket here. That a lot of these animals, particularly the pests, are able to move in after we've already taken out their natural controls. I'm always getting questions from people where they say, I have house centipedes. What should I do? And I say, get down on your knees and thank the Lord, because they're probably running around eating your more serious pests.
Yeah, we have the same kind of thing here where in the desert we've got a number of animals which people are concerned about, and tarantulas, which are nothing at all, scorpions, which do have a painful sting but not nearly as dangerous as people think. And if you just let everything balance and don't do anything, It works much better. Here on our grounds, we don't use any pesticides at all, and we are right in the middle of the desert, and I could go out and in 5 minutes find you a black widow, a brown spider, and a scorpion.
And how do you deal with a person that says it's fine to be sitting here listening to this on the radio, but I'm scared of getting bitten? I know that it itches, or it hurts, or it stings, or whatever. How do you respond
to that
person?
I think a lot of that has to do with, like David said, is to become more aware and knowledgeable so that you don't have so much fear based on ignorance. For example, like the woman was saying that she was going to be moving to New York, I would be much more scared of moving to New York for my life than to be surrounded by bugs walking barefoot.
That might be your least of your problem.
Well, as a New Yorker, the place is great. Bugs are no bugs. And
there's an incredible film that's touring the country now called Microcosmos. It's a French documentary, and it's extreme close-up photography of life in a little field. You see all sorts of drama going on with insects in it. And anyone who can walk out of that movie and still feel that insects are the enemy, I'd like to talk to them.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both. My guests have been David George Gordon, who is a nature writer and author of The Complete Cockroach, a book which all of you must read after having heard him, and Steve Perkle, who is founder and director of the Sonora Arthropod Studies Institute in Tucson, Arizona. We're talking Green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Let's hear from you. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's the dead of winter in Yellowstone Park. There are small patches of open ground right next to some of the geysers and hot springs, and a few streams have verdant green algae on the bottom because the geysers make the stream water hot. But for the park as a whole, it's a very tough winter. And Bob Eakey from the Greater Yellowstone Coalition says the buffalo herd, which numbered 3,500 at the beginning of the winter, is on the move.
This year's, we've had a much higher than normal snowpack. It's about double normal snowpack in the park, and that problem's been compounded by a thaw period and a freezing rain that we had that created an ice layer on the snowpack, which might as well be concrete if you're bison trying to feed in the park right now. So we've seen a mass exodus from Yellowstone, the high elevations of Yellowstone Park, of both elk and bison populations. They're moving to lower elevations outside the park where winter range is more available. It's not covered by snow.
Die-off of bison in the winter is normal, but this year it will be much larger than usual. But death of the buffalo in winter is part of what makes the Yellowstone ecosystem work.
Winter kill is very important for grizzly bears, wolves, other predators, coyotes, you know, even the ravens that live in the park, because you have, this is an early, or throughout the winter, it's a great source of protein for the predators. And in the springtime, especially when bears come out of their dens, they find a lot of these carcasses and they tend to feed on them. And it really nourishes them after their period of hibernation. We have a new series of pack of wolves in Yellowstone that were brought in 2 years ago, and certainly those wolves will be doing very well this year as a result of the winter kill.
For the Yellowstone bison, instinct tells them to move to lower winter range outside the park where there's grass and less snow. Because constant snowmobile traffic on the Yellowstone roads packs the roads hard, the route out of the park is easy. I've crossed the park at night on a snowmobile a couple of times and seen lines of the great beasts plodding along in single file toward the park boundaries. This year, because of the harsh conditions, bison are moving in record numbers. When they enter Montana from the park, they're shot by the Montana Department of Livestock because some bison carry brucellosis, a disease they originally caught from cows. Other animals are trapped at the park border and shipped to slaughter. Montana livestock growers fear cattle herds might become infected, and Montana will lose its brucellosis-free certification, so they've been adamant about keeping the bison within park boundaries. The Yellowstone Coalition says the policy is based on fear and not science, since the threat to cattle is not clear.
Already about 700 bison have been shot or trapped and shipped to slaughterhouses. That's about 20% of the total Yellowstone bison herd. There are hundreds more that are migrating toward the park boundary right now or on their way out of the park, you know, poised to come out of the park. So we're very nervous about this. Park researchers are saying they cannot predict how many animals that stay in the interior of the park will die of winter kill, but because of the harsh winter conditions, the snowpack, the ice layer, they expect the number, the mortality for the number of animals that stay in the park to be very, very high. Already, like I said, we've lost 20% of the herd. You know, if another 700 come out of the park, we're calling for them to be tolerated on public lands, these lower elevation public lands where we don't think there'll be any conflict with cattle and there won't be the brucellosis question.
I'm glad I'm not a bison in Yellowstone this winter, because even if I listened to the Environment Show, I would have trouble choosing between starving in the park and becoming dinner for the wolves or being executed by the Montana Department of Livestock. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. Below-cost irrigation water makes the Central Valley of California one of the most prolific agricultural areas in the world. But wildlife has suffered. Now, changes are underway which will balance the needs of the environment with farming. We'll talk green about the Endangered Species Act. Almost everybody wants to change it, but few agree on how to do it. You think wolves make good pets? Think again. People who know wolves say they belong in the wilderness. And singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell rallies the troops against parking lots. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. The Central Valley of California is one of the most prolific agricultural areas in the world. In fact, it's likely that some of the food swimming around in your gut right now came from there. The thing that makes agriculture possible in this semi-arid region is water. Most of the water comes from the two great rivers of the area, which have been drained to the point where fish and other wildlife are in serious decline. A recent court ruling means that environmental concerns will have to be taken into account when allocating water. Many say it signals a historic change in the way the Central Valley is managed. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
Between the sunny beaches and majestic mountains of California lies the Central Valley. Its two great rivers, the Sacramento and San Joaquin, converge in the state capital before heading out to sea. A great deal of water from those rivers is siphoned off, mostly for irrigation. The U.S. government controls the rivers through hundreds of dams spread throughout the valley. Allocation of water is set by contracts between water users, mostly agriculture, and the federal government. Hal Candy is a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says a recent court decision covering a dam at the southern end of the valley may continue the pace of change towards recognizing environmental concerns.
Last week, the U.S. District Court in Sacramento issued a final order in our longstanding challenge to the renewal of long-term water contracts by the Federal Central Valley Project. And the contracts provided for no releases at all for fish and wildlife downstream. As a result, more than 90% of the normal flow of the river was diverted to agriculture, and the riverbed downstream of the dam often would become dry for large periods of time throughout most of the years. Thus, we feel that the court's decision is a major victory for the environment. The 14 contracts that were at issue in the case were the only ones in the Central Valley Project which did not benefit from environmental review or an analysis of impacts to endangered species.
The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation is in charge of the Central Valley Project, or CVP. The Bureau has been criticized by some for allegedly favoring agricultural interest. Stephen Richardson is the director of policy for the Bureau. He says a 1992 landmark bill passed by Congress called the Central Valley Improvement Act, along with a later agreement called the Bay Delta Accord, has changed the way they do business.
There are in the Central Valley a whole number of interests that, along the Bay Estuary, north and south of the Bay, there had been what was described, I think, in polite company as a water war for about 40 years. We've ended the water wars, and we put a whole new reality into effect on the ground. And that means there's a much more balanced use of the resources of the Central Valley. It means it will sustain agricultural development, and in agricultural development there is enormously important. I mean, 45% of the vegetables consumed in the United States, the fruits and vegetables, are grown on about 4 million acres of farmland there. Not only that, we've got two-thirds of the California homes and businesses rely on the Central Valley for potable water. It's a resource of world-class proportion. It can't allow it to be mismanaged or monopolized by any one group.
Taking environmental concerns like wildlife into effect is expected to lead to less water for agriculture. In the Central Valley, non-irrigated land sells for about $400 to $500 an acre. Irrigated land sells for $4,000 to $5,000 an acre. When the CVP was developed, the government enticed farmers with cheap water. Today, the fate of that agreement is uncertain. Richard Moss is with the Friant Water Users Authority. He represents farmers in the area affected by the recent court decision.
Well, it casts a tremendous cloud of uncertainty as to the ability of our growers to continue to get this much-needed water supply. Without that water supply, we don't grow the crops. While there, at this point in time, there is no apparent desire to turn off the water, the contracts are the legal vehicle under which the United States can make this delivery of water. And without the contracts, we're not sure whether or not the United States can, in fact, continue deliveries.
Seeking middle ground is relatively new for most members in this debate. When the CVP was built, fishermen saw most of the spawning areas for salmon disappear. At one time, the fish from the Central Valley accounted for the second largest salmon run behind the Columbia River in Washington. Zeke Grader is the executive director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association. He says the fishery is still not doing very well, but the anger around the debate has dissipated some.
We really haven't even gotten the restoration. Much of the restoration on the San Joaquin side is still being discussed. But at least we're out of the fighting stages and into the discussion stages. And I think there's been over a period of time, I think a gradual acknowledgement on both sides of both the agricultural and fishery values.
Grader and his fishermen's group have teamed up with environmentalists in fighting for more water. Today, over 80% of California's developed water supply is used by agriculture. The bulk of that water is paid for by taxpayers. Farmers argue that the public investment is worth it because the Central Valley agricultural community pays millions in taxes. But Hal Candee from NRDC says the system still unfairly benefits agriculture to the detriment of the environment.
It's a crazy, irrational system we have built here. We have an enormously powerful agricultural industry here and politicians at the state and federal level who are reluctant to do anything to upset that industry. And yet we have a crisis for the aquatic environment that used to depend on these rivers that are now all dammed up. What we're seeing now is a gradual shift back to some kind of balance where through the efforts of environmental groups and the Environmental Protection Agency and the Fish and Wildlife Service and some of the other state and federal agencies, we're slowly starting to see some water put back into the natural system, starting to see greater wetland habitat for the migratory birds in the Pacific Flyway, starting to see some revival of our fish species, but they're still very much threatened.
Before settlers arrived, Native Americans populated the Central Valley. The rivers teemed with salmon, waterfowl was plentiful, and numerous fruits and vegetables were readily available. With year-round warm temperatures, the Central Valley must have been the ideal place to live. Today, much more is demanded from the valley, and it has come through. Making sure its bounty is sustained will be a difficult process that will almost certainly not come without pain, but may come before the system reaches a crisis. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're Talking Green in the Environment Show, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. You can reach us at 888-49-GREEN. That's 888-49-GREEN. And today, we're talking about the Endangered Species Act. Perhaps the most controversial piece of environmental legislation passed by the United States Congress has been the Endangered Species Act. It calls for the listing of plants and animals when they're on the verge of extinction. Once a species is listed, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is then obliged to come up with a recovery plan, and the controversy begins when the plans call for protection of habitat and limiting human activity on both public and private lands. The act is up for reauthorization, and many conservative members of Congress in the last session, and again in the coming session, will be attempting to modify the act substantially, claiming that it unduly interferes with private property rights and that it harms the economy. Joining me today are three people who have thought a lot about the Endangered Species Act. They're John Kostiak, an attorney with the National Wildlife Federation, which is a national environmental group, Glenn Spain, who is the Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen Associations, and that's a group which represents commercial fishermen who fish in the North Pacific and the Bering Sea, and Don Corsi, who is Dean of the Harris School of Public Policy Studies at the University of Chicago. He's an economist and has written extensively on the economics of preservation of species through the Endangered Species Act. So, having said all that, Don Corsi, let me start with you. When it is reauthorized, does the Endangered Species Act need to be changed, in your judgment?
I think it has to be thought through very, very carefully. The two basic questions which we still can't seem to get our hands around are, what do we want out of an Endangered Species Act? And secondly, what do we want to pay for? And it's not clear that we've decided as a country, and certainly not as a Congress, exactly what the answers to those questions are yet.
And what about you, John? You have been an advocate for the Act in its current form. Do you want to see it changed, or do you just want to see it preserved in light of what may be a pretty substantial attack?
We want to see it changed as well. We think there's a lot of improvements that need to be made with the Act in terms of getting more people engaged in the everyday processes of the Act, having a greater focus on the recovery efforts that are benefiting communities. Right now, there is a de-emphasis on the process of recovering species to the point where they can be delisted. And so a lot of species are managed and kept at the brink of extinction, which inevitably produces conflict. We think that there's a different way to do it where it brings people together to create solutions.
Now, Glenn, you represent a trade organization, and most people think that the trade organizations as a group tend to want to take the Endangered Species Act apart on the ground that it's interfering with the way they do business. Your association sees it differently, I gather.
Yes, we do. We're commercial fishermen. We are stewards of a public resource. You know, there's a lot of talk about private property rights, but what about public property rights? The biological heritage that we depend on for our livelihoods is a public property right, and the ESA protects that.
Now, just let me interrupt you for a moment. When you say we, tell me who your members are.
We represent a large majority of the West Coast fishing industry, particularly the small and mid-sized boat owners, family fishermen, people who provide food and jobs for many communities from San Diego to Alaska. We represent several thousand family fishermen who are dependent on the biological heritage of the sea and particularly inland for salmon resources on the West Coast. And as you know, salmon in many areas have been battered a bit by habitat loss over several generations, and the ESA is now being invoked to protect and recover those species and in the process to help restore our fishing industry and jobs.
So does the Endangered Species Act do that for your members?
It does. It potentially can. And, in fact, it may be the only way we can get everybody to the table to deal with the habitat problems that are causing tremendous amount of declines. Most people don't realize almost every fish species that is caught commercially is habitat dependent. Near-shore environment, water pollution for salmon inland because they go inland to spawn. Those are all habitat questions, and habitat is one of the areas which can be and, in fact, is well addressed under the Endangered Species Act.
Now, Don, as I understand it, though, your concern has to do with whether the economics are really well thought out as we make the trade-offs between interference with the normal working of the economic system and preservation. How does that apply if you look at the situation of the fisheries in the Northwest that that Glenn is worried about?
What you're referring to is a large national study that I did a couple of years ago, which surveyed Americans and their attitudes towards endangered species, found that Americans care much more about so-called charismatic megafauna, large romantic birds and mammals, and much less about some of the smaller elements of the ecosystem. I combine that with another large survey that I had done of how we spend money on these animals and found that as a first approximation, Americans are getting what they want. They care about these charismatic megafauna, and we spend money in a way that reflects that. For instance, we're spending about $500 per animal life saved to save a Florida panther, about $1.5 to save one California condor. At the other end of the list, many, many of these things get zero. And clearly the question here is, are the economic values coinciding with the ecological values? I'm not an expert on Pacific salmon, but they would certainly be part of this question that we need to ask.
Now, taking that a step further, is it sound not to spend money on those things that may not have an immediately translatable economic value?
That's a question of your values. Given that we always have a finite amount of resources to spend on everything, one answer to the question would be, well, Americans are getting what they want, and let the buyer beware. The professional scientific community would not look at it that way. They would say that many of these smaller, less romantic, less well-known animals that we're trying to protect are equally, if not more important, than some of the things that are snacking at the top of the food chain, like a salmon or a grizzly bear or a condor.
Peter, may I make a comment?
Sure. Where do you come out on that, John?
Well, this is John speaking. I'll let Glenn go as well. I think we probably both have a response to that. We come out in saying that it sounds like there are some false trade-offs being suggested here, where we have to choose between protecting the large charismatic species and the smaller ones, when in fact our ability to manage species has evolved, where we can now approach these things more from an ecosystem-oriented perspective, where if we take management efforts to their appropriate degree, we can get benefits that affect all of the large and small species, and we don't have to make those kinds of choices between species. That's the more efficient way of doing it, and it actually makes more sense because, as Glenn was alluding to, what we're really about here is saving the habitats on which both people and the other species rely.
Let me ask you all a question that came in on email from the West Coast. And the question was, how can you worry about bugs and owls while hard-working Americans are losing their jobs and their property?
Let me generate some sparks. Let me field that one. As a representative of a major industry, an environmentally dependent industry, I'd point out that protection under the ESA actually will save jobs. In our case, billions of dollars every year is generated by Pacific salmon harvests. If those harvests are allowed to decline because of habitat loss, dams, and other factors, you're putting whole chunks of the economy out of work. The other thing is, if you take the short term, yes, there might be conflicts, but in the long view, the only source of economic activity we really ultimately have is the natural environment. And the ecosystem is sort of like your brain. It's a very highly evolved, highly specialized, highly interconnected system. I don't think it's wise to take parts at random and start taking them out. It's not wise to do that in the ecosystem. At some point, if you're crashing the ecosystem, you're crashing the very basic food source for our species. There's a false dichotomy that this question presumes. The question presumes that there is an inherent conflict between jobs and the environment, and that is simply not true. It's not true in our case. It's not true, ultimately, in the case of many other industries. And a recent study that Don would be familiar with, done out of MIT, a project on environmental politics and policy, looked at various ESA consultations by Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fishery. It looked over 18,000 of them and concluded that only 11% resulted in any change in the economic activity. And of those, only 181 projects were substantially modified. In other words, 99% of all the things that we do in terms of economic activity, human development, are simply not affected by the ESA. So it's not the case.
Well, I want to thank you all for this discussion on the Endangered Species Act. I've been speaking with John Kostiak, who is an attorney with the National Wildlife Federation, with Glenn Spain, who is the Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association, and Don Corsi, who is Dean of the Harris School of Public Policy Studies at the University of Chicago. You're talking green on the Environment Show. Our number is 888-49-GREEN, and our email address is envshow@aol.com. And if none of that works, my producer will be on the roof with a butterfly net catching your carrier pigeon. Thank you all. wolf cubs are cute and soft. They jump and play just like dog puppies, but don't be fooled. Each year, hundreds of thousands of Americans buy or adopt wolf cubs. Most die within the first few years. Wolves are wild animals and don't respect a human sense of order the way dogs do. They'll tear up your house and even attack their owners. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports that homeless wolves are becoming a major problem.
When Marika Morgan and her husband David adopted a wolf, they thought they'd be one of the few to have a wild animal as a pet. They were absolutely committed to providing a good home for their wolf, Shunka. They built a large and elaborate pen for him and structured much of their lives around him. But it didn't work out.
If someone is thinking of getting a wolf, I would say, do not do it. Despite our wonderful, loving, exhilarating experience with it, it's also heartbreaking. And unless you want to become live in the style of a game farm, there's no, it's just overwhelming. It's just a lot of work, and it's a disservice to the wolf. And also, to bring in an animal from the wild is, it's not right. They don't belong in a home. Again, as I said, I thought we kind of justified that Shunka was already orphaned and so forth, and he kind of fell into our, the opportunity fell into our laps. But the problem also with the people wanting to have wolves is that it creates a whole black market, and wolves belong in the wild. And if you love wolves, support the environment so they have a place to live naturally, to so that there always will be wolves in the wild. Having them in your home serves no purpose. You know, there are wonderful videos that will teach us about wolves, and if we had known in advance what was required of Shunka and the heartbreak that would be involved, we would not have done it. We were naive, and I hope my story is an example to other people who are just as naive and starry-eyed as we were. It's just a very difficult proposition, and even if you do have the time and the funds, I just don't recommend it because it's not a natural way for a wolf to live.
Marika Morgan is the author of Shunka, Life with an Arctic Wolf. Her book details the ups and downs of owning a wolf. Eventually, Morgan had to give Shunka up. He went to an outdoor education center in British Columbia. There he lived happily, meeting school children, until one day someone pulled him out of his cage and shot him at close range. Morgan says wolves are still hated in many parts, and Shunka's death was not unusual. But cultural attitudes are changing. Today, wolves are embraced by many, but that's caused problems too. Kent Weber is the founder of Mission Wolf, which takes in orphaned wolves. He says he has to turn away most wolves offered to him because he just doesn't have the room.
We now have an estimated 500,000 captive wolves and wolf-dog crosses in the United States right now. The majority of these animals are going to end up dead within 2 or 3 years. They're bought as pets, expected to live in the backyard and the home, and it just simply doesn't work. When the people decide they don't want these animals, there's little options for them to do. They basically have to kill the animal. They don't want to do that. If they turn it loose, it's just going to cause problems for the few wild wolves that are left. And, of course, the animals usually die. So today, the majority of captive wolves will end up dead before they're 2 or 3 years old. But the reason people are breeding and selling them today is because they make a lot of money.
Weber tours the country, introducing people to wolves, showing them that while they are wild animals, they are not bloodthirsty killers. During his presentation, he emphasizes that wolves belong in the wild.
Dogs have been with people for thousands of years, and we've taught them to do basically one thing, make us happy. They fetch a stick, and they love to be petted on the head. Wolves do not like to be petted on the head. They don't have any desire to make us happy, and they're independent thinkers. They take care of themselves. They do not need us, and wolves, even though they're born in captivity, are not domesticated. At most, they are tame. Those are some of the behavioral differences between wild animals and domestic animals, wolves and dogs, that cause most of these animals to be very unsuitable in situations. And the sad result is now 80% of those animals will die this next year, but they'll be replaced by another 100,000 to 200,000 puppies for sale next year.
Kent Weber is the founder of Mission Wolf, and Marika Morgan is the author of Shunka, Life with an Arctic Wolf. Because wolves don't respect human rules, pet wolves and hybrids have occasionally attacked their owners. In contrast, there are no recorded attacks by a healthy wild wolf on a human. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
How would you feel about living in a city without automobiles? Tell us your opinion on that or any other environmental issue and join us on the air talking green. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com or through our website, www.enn.com/envshow. You can also order copies of this environment show. Its number is 370. A lot of open space has been gobbled up since Joni Mitchell released the song Big Yellow Taxi in 1970. Her message, that we really don't know what we have until it's gone, is a profound one. Unfortunately, there are even more parking lots today than there were then.
Up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Up a parking lot.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.